Но если кто-то думает, что, совершив подлое военное преступление,
они отделаются помидорами.
Мы знаем, например, кто в Турции набивает свой карман и дает заработать террористам на продаже награбленной в Сирии нефти.
Только, наверное, Аллах знает, зачем они это сделали.
Видимо, Аллах решил наказать правящую клику в Турции.
Мы знаем при этом, что надо делать.
He called the downing of a Russian warplane by Turkey's Air Force a treacherous war crime. He accused Ankara of colluding with Islamic State, and he said Moscow would do more in retaliation than just ban Turkish tomatoes. Vladimir Putin delivered his annual State of the Nation speech to a joint session of parliament this week amid rising tensions with Turkey, an erstwhile Russian ally turned bitter foe. Call it Putin's big fat Turkish divorce. What does the Kremlin leader's belligerent message to Ankara portend? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining us via Skype from Moscow is foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, president of the Left Group and a columnist for Sloan.ru. Welcome back, Vladimir.
Thanks. Good to be back, Brian.
Good to have you always. And joining us from Berlin is journalist, author, and political commentator Leonid Bershitsky, a columnist for Bloomberg View and founding editor of the Russian Business Daily, Vyedomosti. Welcome back, Leonid.
Hi. Nice of you to have me.
Nice of you to agree to join us. Well, along with Putin's live call-in program and his end-of-the-year press conference, which is coming up, Putin's annual speech to Parliament is one of his big set pieces. He has the nation, much of the world's attention. Vladimir, let's start with you. What kind of message was Putin sending? What was he trying to accomplish? Was he trying to frame anything? How did you see the speech?
Oh, it's a little bit hard for me to analyze the domestic and the economic aspects of the speech. I'm not really an expert on this. But in foreign policy terms, I think he engaged in what could be described as a threat substitution compared to a very famous and popular concept in Russia, import substitution. So now he, in foreign policy, engaged in threat substitution.
You have my attention. Let me hear this.
So in that sense, it was clearly all Turkey because he's trying to substitute the threat of Ukrainian Nazis and NATO and US and the U.S. as a global policeman with a much more amenable, well, probably much less threatening threat. I think Turkey is a perfect he has found that threat perfectly in Turkey. And in that sense, obviously, that would be cynical to say this, but the conflict with Turkey, with the downing of the Russian combat jet, has come at a very opportune time. By singling out Turkey, what it allows Putin to do is to maintain the state of alert and confrontation within the Russian society and the Russian political elites, but not with the West entirely. It allows him to single out Turkey as a part of the West, but not really the West. So it allows him to have a conflict, a confrontation, and at the same time to improve the relationship with the West. Because he, you know, ironically, and he knows this, that many Western leaders and NATO members really view, if not fully share, but tend to agree with some aspects of what Putin is saying about Turkey and its role in Syria and its role in fighting, in not really fighting ISIL. So he has a perfect threat to focus the public attention at home and to maintain the state of siege. But at the same time, he has the opportunity to improve the relationship with the West and continue and to go ahead with his grand anti-terrorist coalition, which Russia wants to be a part of. But it also allows him to cover up the relatively troublesome conduct of the Russian air war in Syria and the fact that Russia seems to be getting bogged down. We are in the third month of the air campaign with relatively little to show for it. And there are signs that Russia is doubling down. There are reports that Russia is fortifying a second airfield and is prepared to increase the number of combat jets on operation in Syria to about 100, and probably deploy additional ground forces to secure the base in Homs. And there are also reports confirmed by the Russian general staff that there are ground artillery units already operating in Syria. So having Turkey as someone who is stabbing Russia in the back in Syria is very useful. It allows to essentially to say that if anything goes wrong with our little war in Syria, here's a guy who stabbed us in the back, and that's why we are suffering losses. So I think he has found the perfect threat and is going to capitalize on that for a while. The downside, of course, is that this can get out of control and could escalate particularly with the deployments of high-tech systems like S-400 to Syria. And also the downside is that for Russia to pull out of Syria in a very noble way, Russia needs a political settlement. And for a political settlement, it needs active cooperation of Turkey, which is one of the major sponsors and supporters of the Syrian opposition. And so having this spat with Turkey actually complicates Russia's strategy to successfully get out of Syria before it's too late.
Isn't there another cost here, too, that up until now, Turkey was considered pretty much an ally of Russia? Putin and Erdogan had this chemistry between them. Putin always held up Turkey as this country that's not afraid to stand up to the West. So is there a cost there in terms of the loss of what was probably an important ally?
No, I don't think so. I don't think Turkey was that much of an ally. Clearly, it was personal. And we have this situation in which it is no longer business, it is personal for Putin, and it's reflected in his rhetoric. And frankly, he is pushing the situation pushing Erdogan into a corner with a very harsh rhetoric and with the accusations of Erdogan's and his family, inner circle complicity with ISIL. So it's really bogging us down, locking us into a confrontation, at least rhetorical, with the Turkish leadership, from which there is no clear and safe way out, because Erdogan is not the guy who is going to back down. And it's not that Turkey was an ally. It was just that Turkey clearly wanted to maintain a cordial relationship with Russia. And in some ways, it satisfied certain Russian concerns and played along with Russia, particularly on Crimea and the Russian operations in Ukraine. So, frankly, Erdogan had the right to expect the same kind of treatment from Russia in Syria, where Erdogan and Turkey has immense interests.
Yeah, and you noted basically correctly that there's the West isn't entirely happy with Turkey's actions in Syria, but the West and Turkey basically share the same broad goals of removing Assad from power and then turning it on an Islamic State, where Russia seems to be pursuing a different agenda, no?
That is correct. But again, the priority for the West is to clamp down on ISIL and to defeat ISIL. And I think here, there are many in the West, particularly in the United States, who do not really see that who see the Turkish response to ISIL as underwhelming, and in fact clearly think that Turkey could have done more. That's reflected in calls by the U.S. to close down the border between Turkey and the area border with Syria controlled by ISIL.
Yeah. You got to wonder if this is going to be one of these cases that might push the West and Turkey closer together.
This is something that gives Putin an opportunity to drive a wedge in the West. Mm-hmm. He has found the perfect target, and he knows that the West, well, clearly, if it comes down to a shooting war between Turkey and Russia, obviously the West would have no other recourse but to
back Turkey,
fulfill the obligations under the North Atlantic Treaty. But not until then. I think NATO would do its best to stay out.
Yeah, no, NATO is doing its best to stay out, actually. That's clear from the comments of NATO officials. Leonid, in your column yesterday, you noted that Putin spent most of the speech, you correctly noted, that Putin spent most of the speech in domestic politics. He just spent 3 minutes on Turkey. But this is true. But it was the threats to Ankara that made the headlines. It was the threats to Ankara that kind of defined this speech. All the sound bites were about that. What are your thoughts? What do you think the overall message he was trying to send here is?
Well, I don't think the annual State of the Nation address is a collection of sound bites. That's not how they're written, and that's not how they're delivered.
But that's how they're received.
Well, the press has its own mechanisms for reacting to speeches like this, and they look for a quote, and they found the turkey quotes because the rest of it was pretty pale. And it didn't make much sense to people who don't follow the Russian economy too closely. So, that part, and it's closer to the news, of course. So, that's what got...
Andy led with it. Andy led with Turkey. He started with Turkey.
Well, that's mainly because, I have to talk about stuff that people are discussing, that's closer to the news. But that's not the important part of that speech. I mean, the threat was pretty... As I think I pointed out in the column, the threat was pretty amorphous. He didn't really say what he was going to do. He just said that, Russia wouldn't limit itself to banning Turkish tomatoes. But that is exactly what the Russian government has decided to do, to limit itself to tomatoes. It's not introducing sanctions against Turkish industrial goods. It hasn't officially canceled atomic power plant project. It's not cutting off the supply of gas. It's not taking any really strong economic measures against Turkey. And it's not really taking any military measures against it either, unless you count the bombing raids against the Turkmen near the Turkish border. So the actual Russian reaction to the downing of the plane has been rather mild. And, Putin's speech didn't change anything about that.
Uh-huh.
I agree. The reaction is, Putin is, the reaction is underwhelming. The threat is rhetorical, largely. And I think that that reflects the thing that Russia is not really intent on escalating the conflict. It just wants to use it for domestic consumption.
But this also suggests that the threat is it's going to be an ongoing thing. I mean, I don't see either of them backing down now. So where does this go then? If it's only going to stay at this rhetorical level,
that's the beauty of it. That's the beauty of it. It can play for a while without any grave repercussions.
Uh huh. I mean, one of the things that's been coming up on this is that, I mean, this friendship between Putin and Erdogan is kind of an anomaly. And Turkey and Russia have historically been foes. They've competed in the Caucasus and the Balkans and in the Black Sea region. And one of the things I'm wondering is, are we returning to a historic norm here? Do you think that's the case?
Well, I do not see clear historic parallels here because the interests are different and the situations are different. Unless, of course, there is a potential for foul play. And, of course, both countries have the capability to hurt the opponent's interests in a very significant way. But I don't think they're going to do this. Unless, of course, the Russians play the Kurdish card. And there are certain signs that there is some coordination between Russia and the Kurds against the forces that Turkey supports in Syria. And, of course, there is some element of coordination between Russia, Assad, and the Kurdish forces. And there is a push for the Russians, by the Russians, to have the Kurds align themselves with Assad against other rebels. So that's going to raise eyebrows and that's going to raise concerns. But how the Turks decide to respond, I don't really know. They have the capability.
Do they play the Tatar card?
Well, that would be hard because that's pretty far away from their borders and the FSB has this under control. I would probably pay attention to places like, Karabakh, Abkhazia, that sort of thing.
Well, there's also interesting reports out of Gagauz, the autonomous region inside of Moldova that is pro-Moscow. It's Orthodox Christian, Russian-speaking Turks.
Right.
And the interesting thing coming out of there, because there was a lot of fears last year that Russia was going to turn this into another Transnistria. But what's interesting that's happening there is the Gagauz are supportive of Turkey. You're seeing a lot of paradoxical things here. My Georgian colleagues are telling me that in Georgia, the attitudes are more pro-Russian on this conflict. So you're seeing a lot of contradictory stuff out there.
Right. Again, as I said, that's the beauty of it. But going back to Gagauz, I would probably add that, well, there's enormous Turkish influence, the humanitarian influence in Gagauz. They invested huge amounts of time and money into humanitarian programs and business investment in Gagauz. But politically, Russia has Gagauz autonomy under control, and it would not play that card. Mm-hmm.
There's something I wrote on earlier this week, and I actually quoted both of you on some on different aspects of this. Is that Russia's becoming increasingly isolated, in that it's lost much of the West. It has no allies west of Smolensk. In Syria, it's alienating some powerful players to the south, Turkey and Saudi Arabia in the Gulf states in particular. Vladimir, you had a really good piece in Vedomosti on this diplomacy of liberation, where you basically spelled out the logic behind Russia's behavior over the past couple of years. But you, at the end of the piece, you'd say this has its limits and its costs are going to come due sooner or later. You don't see that these costs are starting to come due now with this, or how would the Turkey situation fit into that logic?
Well, I think that the costs are largely bearable at this point. They can continue with this policy, and the economic costs are quite bearable. Mm-hmm. There's going to be no domestic repercussions for the Russian leadership due to adventurous foreign policy. Mm-hmm. In fact, as I wrote in the same piece, foreign policy is a major source of political support and legitimacy now. Mm-hmm. People are just ecstatic about Russia banging other people's heads in different regions, as long as that does not result in massive Russian casualties.
Right. And Leonid, you opened a recent column on this, posing the question, has Vladimir Putin finally overreached? Has he, in your opinion?
Well, I think he's coming closer to that. I agree with Vladimir about the foreign policy, or, you know, the expansionist policy, the aggression that Putin has demonstrated outside of Russia's borders is probably the strongest source of his legitimacy now, and the strongest source of his popularity, domestic popularity. But Russia is actually, you know, it has enough resources and enough experience surviving on its own and moving towards autarky. But it's done that before, and it can probably survive without too many allies for a long time, especially while Putin's popularity or the regime's popularity is sustained by the external aggression and you know, the way most Russians like it. But also, I think alienating one after another some of the most powerful players in the regions where Russia has interests, and including areas that are very close to Russia's borders, is not really sustainable, despite Russia's self-sufficiency and the high popularity of Putin and his regime, pretty much because the world is now much more interconnected, not just economically, but also politically, and, you know, in terms of how action must be concerted. There must be consensus for anything to happen in today's world. You know, the leaders meet much more frequently than they used to in the days when the Soviet Union was similarly isolated. Basically, you have to make alliances, you have to negotiate, you have to make deals. Otherwise, you're sidelined. And, you know, after a while, you know, if you're so lonely and unloved as Putin's Russia is, at some point you're irrelevant. Nobody's asking you about anything. Nobody's talking to you. Mm-hmm. And people just go ahead and do what they want to do without asking your advice. And irrelevance is not the kind of future that the people who are backing Putin now want for Russia. They want increased relevance. Mm-hmm. But he's crossing the line to where he's achieving the opposite goal.
Yeah, no, this is, you said Russians have proven themselves to be able to live under autarky before. I agree with you, but not this Russia and not in this world. And I have to wonder, this. I know this is a popular thing people say, that the Russians will eat dirt for the motherland. Is this what people will often, the way people will often frame it? But I'm not sure about this generation of Russians, and I'm not sure that autarky work can is sustainable in today's world. Is, I mean, would you agree?
Yeah, I definitely would. This is something that, you know, Russians have done before, and they might, like, if pushed, they might do it again, but it's no longer an imperative, and it's no longer modern, you know. It's not the kind of thing that you can do for a long time without really falling behind on, you know, trade, technology, being included in, you know, international political processes. It used to work, but it won't work anymore for any, you know, for any length of time.
So the question is, when do we hit that tipping point?
Yeah, and I think, you know, if Putin goes on like this, and, you know, Turkey is not the last big enemy that he's going to find, you know, if this goes on into next year and more countries fall away, like if he quarrels with China or India, or I don't know, I mean, how many countries are left to quarrel with?
You have to wonder when it's going to hit to that point. And there's a lot of points of contention with China. We haven't heard so much about the big alliance with China for a long time. And
that's true. Because
I think Moscow realized they would have been a junior partner in that relationship, but they don't want to be a junior partner to anybody.
I would agree with Leonid that what Russia wants is probably not allies. Russia is not seeking allies in the Western sense of the term, but what Russia is seeking is relevance and recognition of Russia's international relevance, and the recognition not from, let's say, China or South Africa or Brazil. It seeks recognition from the United States and to a certain extent from the EU, particularly from Germany and France, not so much from the British. And I think the Syrian venture is a useful war in that sense, because it allows Russia to demonstrate the only type of relevance it continues to have, which is military, in a conflict that is of utmost, growing and probably now becoming of existential importance to at least to the EU and to a certain extent to the United States. And it's going to play that card as long as it is possible. It sees it as a very advantageous situation in which it can be relevant, it could be sought as a partner, and it could contribute in a really meaningful way.
There's another thing I've been trying to wrap my head around on this, too, and is that in the past, we always said that Putin's goal was to change the international system as it exists, the rules-based order that's existed since the end of the Cold War. And I have to wonder now if the goal isn't shifting into just ending the isolation. And I had this in mind as I was watching the speech yesterday. There was criticisms of the West were marked noticeably absent, conspicuously absent, at least explicit ones. And you have to wonder, is Putin's goal shifting now just to end this isolation, or does he still want to rewrite the post-Cold War international order?
Well, I think there is a much more appreciation of the limits of Russian capability to shape the rules of the world. Of course, the objective remains, but perhaps the Russians have decided that they should limit their objectives. They should limit the means which they can deploy to achieve those objectives, and they wound down the rhetoric. I agree. There's been no mention of the world order that Russia doesn't like in Putin's speech, compared to the speech last year and the year before that. So I think they're just adjusting their objectives and to the limited means they have, but they would pursue those objectives nonetheless.
Leonid, would you agree with that?
Yes, I do agree. I think the reason the rhetoric is less confrontational in the speech is that you know, Putin is really trying to you know, play with the cards that he's dealt himself, pretty much. And, you know, what would he gain by repeating the inflammatory rhetoric from last year's speech. Mm. I don't think he sees any purpose to it anymore. Mm. And he also realizes that he's got great intuition, and you know, he's very much an experienced politician, so he cannot miss the fact that things are not going as well at home as they should be. He's talking here not exactly to like the broad audience. He's talking to the elite, to mm-hmm. the people assembled in that hall, and he's trying to tell them that, okay, you know, we're holding on now because of our, you know, because of our wars and because of our, you know, so-called new assertiveness. But that is no reason to forget about what's going on at home, and bad stuff is going on.
Well, no, and it was interesting. You raised this in your column as well, that this kind of shift to the domestic aspects in the speech coincided with all these rumors that Alexei Kudrin might be returning to government. There was a piece in Gazeta Rue about this, to this effect, this week. Kudrin was tweeting very positively about the speech, and you almost felt his hand in the speech. Kudrin is much liked and respected in the West, and you have to wonder if there's going to be another turn West. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. Did you sense that?
Yes, definitely. That's why I actually quoted Kudrin's
tweet. You quoted Kudrin's tweet.
In the column. I don't know if he had any role in actually writing the speech, but I think, the Putin administration recently supported a forum that Kudrin's organization held with all sorts of retired and semi-retired system liberals, people who were shaping economic policy and social policy under Medvedev. Support from the presidential administration for that forum is a sign that, you know, there's a shift occurring, that Putin wants to, have more input from these guys and not just the law enforcers and, the defense elite. That he basically wants to go back to the situation where these two groups were in balance. And there used to be a time when that was the case, during Putin's second term, especially, mm-hmm. And during, Medvedev's term to an extent. So these quasi-liberals, people like Kudrin, Putin wants to bring them in again in hopes that they can fix the economic situation and sort of shore up his position on that front. But I think that's pretty much a false hope, because without pretty much squashing the other branch, the one that relies on force, pretty much, without removing them, the liberals are going to be powerless to change anything. You know, the economy is not going to be revived while the corrupt prosecutors and cops maintain their grip on it.
No, as I read your column, I was the first half I felt, okay, there's light at the end of the tunnel. And by the time I finished, I was back to where I was when I started again, because you make the point, unless they change the whole system, the liberals aren't going to have any effect whatsoever. One more thing before we move on to the second part, when we talk about what Putin didn't discuss, which I thought was equally as interesting, the energy card. One thing that was conspicuously missing from all the things that Russia sanctioned on Turkey was energy exports. And today, Turkey turned the tables. Turkey announced that it was going to be cutting back by 25% on LPG imports from Russia, which is used in automobiles. Turkey is one of the largest users in the world of this kind of gas, and Russia accounts for nearly a third of its imports. And this got me thinking again that Russia's ability to play the energy card is severely diminished. No?
Yes, I would say so, especially because of the the oil glut and the low energy prices, low prices of all sorts of gas and, you know, hydrocarbon fuel. This is a buyer's market now, and the sellers, not just Russia, but all of them, you know, Saudi Arabia and Venezuela and, you know, all that OPEC countries, they're basically in the position of people who are sitting there and waiting to be chosen.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, the buyer chooses who to buy from, and there's a lot of supply in the market. So the Russian energy companies and, you know, Gazprom and Rosneft and all these state behemoths, they're basically, you know, they need their customers more than their customers need them.
Mm-hmm. Vladimir, would you agree with that?
I think energy is where Turkey could hurt Russia most if they choose to do so, because Turkey is an extremely important market for Russian gas to gas from. It's one of the largest, probably the second largest, correct? Correct me, Leonid, if I'm wrong. Russian gas market in Europe. And most of the Russian trade surplus with Turkey is from energy sales. Turkey, unlike Ukraine, is in a much better position to diversify energy supplies, natural gas supplies. And we can see already Turkey intensifying cooperation with Azerbaijan on imports of Azerbaijani gas. And we see Erdogan flying off next week to Turkmenistan for energy talks with the Turkmenistan's leadership. So they're going to play this, and they know that they can hurt Russia significantly on energy. So there is an element of leverage that they have over Russian policies.
All right. Well, that's a good way to shift gears in the second half. And in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at why what Putin did not say in his speech may be just as important as what he did say. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me via Skype from Moscow is foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, president of the Left Group and a columnist for Slon.ru. And joining us from Berlin is journalist, author, and political commentator Leonid Bershitsky, a columnist for Bloomberg View and founding editor of the Russian business daily Vedomosti. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Владимир Путин выступает с посланием федеральному собранию.
Владимир Путин нацелил парламентариев на борьбу с терроризмом. Президент затронул проблемы международных отношений и делового климата. Препятствием для нее, по словам президента, по-прежнему остается коррупция.
Владимир Путин также отметил успехи сельского хозяйства.
Кроме того, президент коснулся темы религии, коррупции.
Емко, содержательно, эмоционально.
So in a one-hour speech, Putin did not utter the word Ukraine once. He didn't attack the authorities in Kyiv. He didn't talk about the plight of Russian speakers in Donbass. He didn't even mention the conflict in Donbass. He mentioned Crimea only in passing. Vladimir, can we read anything into this? Is Ukraine being pushed off the agenda entirely? Is Putin giving up on his goals in Ukraine? Is this a tactical retreat? What can we read into the conspicuous absence of Ukraine in that speech entirely?
Well, I do not think it's gone entirely. And
from
I
the speech it was.
It's gone from the speech, but not from Russia's agenda and from Russia's objectives. It just reflects the reality that I think Moscow sees events in Ukraine developing in the right direction to reflect Moscow's interests. And it just sees no additional value in ramping up confrontational rhetoric with regard to Ukraine. I think Moscow is fairly satisfied with the way things are going under the Minsk II. It can probably live with a stalemated conflict, a frozen conflict, and keep the border open. It controls the stateless, the separatist entities, and the only solution that it can agree with under Minsk II is for Ukraine to recognize those stateless as autonomous and special status regions with significant powers within Ukraine. And I think Russia is counting that the West would probably pressure Kyiv into accepting those terms. So for Putin to not to mention Ukraine reflects his desire to mend ties with the West and not to create additional irritants with it, with the rhetoric that's not going to help anyway.
Now, that's interesting because I actually see them not getting what they want in Ukraine right now, because I think actually a frozen conflict might suit Kyiv, or Kyiv could live with a frozen conflict because the rest of the country can go on reforming and Russia's influence in Kyiv would be diminished. I thought what Putin was trying to do was get the separatist republics reintegrated into Ukraine on his terms in this federalization scheme that would basically paralyze the country and turn it into Bosnia-Herzegovina, for example. And he's not getting that. And I saw the absence of it in the speech as an indication that they were losing. But you appear to disagree.
Yeah, I disagree. I think they view, well, they obviously want, you know, want those areas integrated into Ukraine on Russia's terms. The only solution that they view possible in Ukraine is Minsk II under Russian interpretation. And I think that the political calculus in Kyiv is shifting in Russia's favor. And I think their hope is if they do not raise hell in Donbass and just wait for a while, they could see a new political realignment in Kyiv that would be advantageous to Russia's interests, and that would eventually lead Kyiv to recognize those areas as special status regions with significant powers. So Russia is playing the waiting game. They can they can afford to do this for a while.
Now,
they're not abandoning the goals, though.
The calculus is that there's going to be shifts in the elite's position is going to shift, or elections are going to produce a different government?
I think both. There could be coalitions within the current political lineup, or new parliamentary elections that would produce a new political lineup. I think the expectation is that Poroshenko would get desperate enough to align himself with members of the oppositionist blocs to produce a new coalition or something like that.
Mm.
They want to control Kyiv's policies, not Donetsk's policies.
Of course, the goal has always been Kyiv. But I was just in Ukraine last week. I spent a week in Ukraine last week. I was in Odessa for most of the week, but I was in Kyiv at the end. But I didn't get a sense of that that anything was shifting in Russia's favor. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist just because I didn't see it.
What I'm saying is that the way Moscow views the developments, it doesn't mean that their assessment of the events is objective.
Uh-huh.
Correct.
Okay,
that's an entirely different issue.
Leonid, what are your thoughts on this? The absence of Ukraine from the speech, and where is this conflict right now in Russia's eyes?
Well, I would agree with Vladimir that what's going on there now benefits Putin more than it does Kyiv. I see your point about how the reintegration of the separatist held regions would be, a good idea for Putin because it's like a fifth column inside Ukraine. But a frozen conflict suits him fine as well, mainly because it's destroying Ukraine from inside as effectively as if the regions were reintroduced and sent their legislators to parliament. The conflict drains Ukraine's resources. It is a constant distraction. It's spreading weapons around Ukraine. It's sort of increasing the general lawlessness which already exists there. It's also a source of corruption, which is always helpful in Putin's trying to keep neighboring countries in check.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically, he's doing the same with that area as he's doing with Transnistria, which gives him a pretty powerful hand in Moldova and in that entire region. So I think he's perfectly satisfied with a frozen conflict. I was actually rather surprised, though, that he didn't mention Ukraine in the speech, because he'd just come back from Crimea, where he'd launched the energy bridge, which is this undersea cable that is sending energy to Crimea, and that's
I don't really understand whether it's really helped to restore power.
Right.
Throughout, I mean, there are no reliable reports.
No,
so I don't really understand
tell me about
that's
it.
Worked.
No, I know.
But I thought you would have mentioned that because it's, you know, it's a strong evidence that Russia really wants Crimea and that it's developing it and that it's spending money to make it independent from Ukraine, not just in terms of who's running it, but also in terms of energy, food supply, maybe at some point even water supply. Because now basically Crimea is dependent on Ukraine for all these things. So for Putin, it would be a powerful argument for his domestic audience that he's doing all that stuff, that he's actually working to integrate Crimea, and that he hasn't just seized it to, sit and watch it being deprived of basic necessities by Ukrainian activists across the border. So why he didn't mention that, I don't know. He should have. But in terms of, talking about the rest of the Ukrainian situation, I think it's a good idea for him to keep silent about it because, right now, the uneasy, no peace, no war situation suits him fine.
Mm. Now, I'm going to play devil's advocate here a little bit because I think Putin's basically on plan C now in Ukraine. Plan A, I think, was the seizure of Novorossiya to get the land bridge to Crimea. That didn't work out. Plan B was to try to get the separatist territories reintegrated as a Trojan horse to turn Ukraine into Bosnia-Herzegovina. That doesn't appear to be working out. And now Plan C is a frozen conflict, which I think is acceptable to both parties. But I the impression again, and it's just an impression from it's a country I lived in the early 90s, but it's an impression right now from just a week spent there. And I'm seeing a different country. I was in Odessa. I heard Ukrainian spoken on the streets in Odessa. You never used to hear Ukrainian spoken on the streets in Odessa. The language issue has become completely depoliticized. I was at a conference. I was in Odessa for a conference where there were participants from all over Ukraine. And I saw a group of students from Lviv speaking with a group of students from Odessa. The group of students from Lviv spoke Russian to the students from Odessa. The Odessa students responded in Ukrainian. And they were both stubbornly being polite is the way I described it as I was watching it. I never saw things like that happening before. I agree with you, the corruption's a problem, and I agree with you, the pace of reform is slow. But in this, if you have a frozen conflict scenario and Ukraine does get its act together, you could see it completely slip away from Russia's influence entirely. And I'm just not sure whose side time is on. I think it depends a lot on what the authorities in Kyiv are able to do right now. No?
Well, I don't really understand how Ukraine could entirely drop out of Russia's orbit, frankly. Russia is still, after all this, after all the sanctions on both sides and all that, the bad blood and the mutual accusations and the annexation of Crimea, the invasion of Donetsk, Russia is still Ukraine's biggest trading partner. And that's not just because of gas. Ukraine is taking much less Russian gas now. The economies are still interconnected. There's a lot of Ukrainians working in Russia. Countries speak the same language. I don't really see how even an extreme nationalist government in Kyiv could eliminate all of that. Mm. I mean, they've been trying, but they're, frankly, I have serious doubts about whether they're really running the country beyond a few blocks in Kyiv. And, the fact that the reforms that they keep talking about are just not happening, probably the best evidence that they're not running it or running it in some different way than they're describing, The corruption schemes that existed under the old Yanukovych government are back and, they're flourishing. They're just being used by different people. Ukraine is Ukraine, and it's not 2 years after the Maidan uprising, we can see that, you know, it's not a different country. It's the same country. It's the same post-Soviet festering, you know, corrupt semi-state.
I think we got to agree to disagree there. I see slow progress, but I see
Let me just jump in a little. Yeah, Vladimir. I would probably add, and I agree entirely, almost entirely with Leonid. It is Plan C. It is Plan C, and there is a possibility that Plan C could turn into Plan B at a certain point, and that's why Putin needs the West, and that's why he wants to be very cooperative on Syria, so that there would be a time, maybe just a few months, maybe years down the road, where the West would force Kyiv's hands to accept the settlement that favors Moscow. But there is also Plan D, but the Plan C is also okay, because as Leonid points out, Ukraine cannot isolate itself from the frozen conflict. And the key difference, the frozen conflict would keep eating up Ukraine like a slow-growing cancer. And the key difference with Transnistria and Moldova is that there is no Dniester River to clearly separate the two sides and create a kind of barrier that would, if not entirely impenetrable, but could be easily defended and essentially isolate the two entities. And I think the influence, you know, Transnistria has zero influence on Moldova's politics at this point and on Moldova's direction. And I think the public mood in Moldova has shifted and they don't really care about Transnistria anymore, with a few exceptions. Ukraine is an entirely different situation. They cannot separate from the Donbas. And that's why I think the frozen conflict suits Russia, because it would keep influencing politics. Mm-hmm. Even if there is no Minsk settlement, the frozen conflict would keep influencing politics in Kyiv and would create opportunities for Moscow to play those politics. And it prevents the scenario, the Polish option, in which Moscow loses influence and Ukraine goes entirely to the West, because, you know, unlike Poland, the gates of the West are not entirely open for Ukraine. Poland was integrated into NATO and got EU membership, neither of which is an offer to Ukraine. And I think Moscow understands that perfectly well.
Do you think there could be something along the lines of the Georgian option, where you have two frozen conflicts, and yet the government in Tbilisi was able to pursue meaningful reforms and move themselves more in alignment with the West? Not that they have been perfect, but they've managed to make a lot of progress.
Well, possible, but the argument against this is the size of the country.
Mm. Simply because of Ukraine's size, Russia will be able to have more opportunities.
Right, it would be extremely difficult for Ukraine to implement the kinds of reforms or the kind of anti-Russian reforms that Georgia under Saakashvili implemented.
Mm-hmm.
And let's face it, Saakashvili was using the iron hand to implement those reforms,
yes,
which is not an offer in Ukraine.
No, not with that civil society the way it is right now. No, they wouldn't stand for that. All right, on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me via Skype from Moscow has been foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, president of the Left Group and a columnist for Sloan.ru. And joining us from Berlin has been journalist, author, and political commentator Leonid Bershitsky, a columnist for Bloomberg View and founding editor of the Russian business daily Vermesti. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Thanks, Brian. Always good to be there.
Always good to have you. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my totally awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, senior producer for RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.